Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome again to Common Sense Conversations. I'm Ryan Alexander. I'm president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. TCS, which is kind of our short name for Taxpayers for Common Sense, because in Washington you must have acronyms, is an independent budget watchdog that fights for the American taxpayer. We work to root out and eliminate waste where we see it. But our work at TCS is not always glamorous. We read bills, we make spreadsheets, you know, we tell people what we've learned. We try to tell people that when we find things that they should do something about it. So the focus of our work means that we don't always work on things that are in the headlines. Sometimes they are, but particularly right now, they're not in the headlines. Between talk of impeachment, the debates involving, 8 million candidates, and the kind of terrible, horrible stories from the border, nobody's paying attention to fiscal issues right now, even though we're right in the middle of appropriation season. Or by we, I mean the country and Congress. If you listen to any of our past conversations, you've heard a lot about examples of spending that doesn't make sense, from subsidies to farmers to budget gimmicks in the defense spending bills. But I want to talk today about kind of the flip side of spending issues, examples where the federal government leaves money on the table or just truly throws it out the window. There are examples all over the government, from failing to charge or collect royalties for oil and gas, to letting contractors get away with not meeting their obligations to the taxpayer, to sending payments to people who are not providing services or may even be dead. Here to talk about it are a bunch of my colleagues from TCS. We have Steve Ellis, Executive Vice President.
Hey, thanks for being here, folks.
Autumn Hanna, Vice President.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And Wendy Jordan, Senior Policy Analyst for National Security.
Hello, everyone.
So let's start with the basic of what it means for the federal government to leave money on the table. Let's start with the tax code. The theory behind tax preferences is that they'll encourage specific behavior. We give companies a tax break for research and development expenses, for example, to encourage innovation. Whether or not that policy or any other tax break is needed and effective is what makes the policies wasteful or worthy. You know, one of the, I think, the kind of worst example of places where we are, just have insane tax policy is the idea of retroactive tax extenders. Steve, you want to go into detail there?
Sure. I'd be glad to, Ryan. So tax extenders are this little package of, or not so little package, of rifle shot, small bore tax provisions that benefit one particular industry or another. They've been, it's a hodgepodge of provisions dealing with everything from the depreciation on NASCAR racetracks to racehorses and the depreciation for thoroughbreds to provisions dealing with, you name it, a whole bunch of energy tax credits and other things. And these are all short term. They are only typically in place for a year, 2 years, in some cases 3 years, and then they expire. And this package of all these different disparate provisions is called the tax extenders package, and it's really the little caboose that could. It catches a ride on large pieces of legislation. The bailout in 2008 actually had tax extenders as a sweetener to move it along. They were also in the fiscal cliff deal. So there's been they kind of are the cockroaches of the Washington policy establishment. They always seem to survive. But I guess you could also call them zombies, because they are often retroactively extended. So essentially, the current package that's being debated, all those provisions expired at the end of 2017. And so now they're talking about doing a retroactive extension for 2 years for some of them, 3 years for other ones. And so these are provisions that actually, some of them are going to expire at the end of this calendar year. And we're basically subsidizing, and this is really what gets to about the foregone revenue. Whatever business decisions people did to take advantage of these tax provisions happened a year ago. So we're subsidizing them for behavior that already occurred. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, there's no way you can argue that it's encouraging behavior. And, within that, I think there's also a real question of kind of if you look at how the individual tax extenders get in the package, there's a direct tie to political power. You know, if you think about the racehorse provision and, which you can explain, or any other examples where that's just narrow, but it's connected to a very powerful member of Congress.
Well, and powerful is almost an understatement. I mean, Senator McConnell, who's the majority leader in the Senate, is from Kentucky. You may be familiar with the Kentucky Derby. And there is a tax provision that he got into the 2008 Farm Bill that then later became part of this passel of tax extenders that essentially allows thoroughbred racehorse owners to write the animal off in two years for these three-year-old horses, which normally it would be 7 or 8 years. Well, it's not lost on me that the Triple Crown, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes are all three-year-old horses. And so, and Kentucky is, and I mean, this is the sport of kings, as they call themselves, and yet we're subsidizing them for this behavior. Also, the last thing I would just point out of this, by only doing these short-term extensions, but basically doing them time and time and time again, they're masking the true cost. Because it's really, you know, if you do two-year extensions five times, the 10-year cost is a lot greater than what it looks like when you only do a two-year extension. If these were so important, we just did the biggest tax legislation in 30 years at the end of 2017, and yet these didn't worm their way into the code.
And my favorite fact, the day the tax bill passed, Senator Hatch from Utah, who's the chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate, introduced the tax extenders package with retroactive tax breaks. So, you know, it just goes to show you that they are, in fact, as Steve calls them, the cockroaches of the tax world. And Autumn?
I mean, I would just say that, to Steve's point, that these just keep coming back and back. I mean, we spent over $12 billion on the biodiesel tax credit, one of the extenders that hitches a ride in this package and is on the table to be retroactive extended, where production is linked to not the market and what demands are, but whether or not people can get the tax credit.
Yep, great things to distort markets. But Autumn, while you're there, let's go move on to natural resources. So when we talk about natural resources revenues, it's the money that developers and companies do or should pay American taxpayers for the privilege of extracting oil, gas, timber, solar resources from taxpayer-owned lands. We've been doing a lot of work on this for 25 years. Autumn and her team just produced a great report. But, you know, first you want to start with how royalties work and how we should see them work?
So as Ryan just mentioned, oil and gas companies that drill offshore in our federal waters or on land in our public lands are required to pay royalties to the American taxpayer for the oil and gas that they remove from those places that we own. And as the owners, we have a right to be fairly compensated, and that is also in federal law. But we, just like any private landowner gets compensated for what they own, the federal taxpayer on public land should be compensated. And much of that revenue comes through royalties. Taxpayers across the board receive royalties from oil and gas. We also get them from coal and timber. We receive revenues from these other natural resources. One place we still don't receive a royalty is hard rock minerals, and that is definitely a topic we want to talk about another day here and the reforms we're trying to get there where there's no royalty paid.
But just to emphasize that, that means that people extract gold, a hard rock mineral, from federal lands and pay us nothing for it.
So that's not the problem with oil and gas. We do get a royalty, but there are lots of other problems with the royalty system and how it's managed. And federal oil and gas right now is something that, through the federal government, is managed at the Department of Interior. They provide access to these resources through leasing and work towards responsible development. We have bonding and other issues in place. Taxpayers, unfortunately, are losing throughout this system from the beginning of lease through the collection of royalties. And this week, we've really been digging on the royalty side, so that's what we're going to talk about now. The reason that royalties are so important is because we do own a lot of valuable resources, and that does generate a lot of income. To be clear, TCS wholeheartedly supports extraction. It's very important that we get the oil and gas out of the ground for the benefit of it creates jobs. This is an important energy source. And in places where it makes sense and it's done responsibly, this is to the benefit of the taxpayer. But the problem is that we've seen repeatedly flaws in the system, some entrenched subsidies for that are centuries old, and a system that doesn't have a lot of oversight or transparency and has really just become another subsidy to the oil and gas industry. Right now, what we're looking at is policies on royalties that haven't changed for 100 years, and we're collecting far less royalties than states and private landowners, and so that's something that we've been digging into. In fact, since 2011, the GAO has gone through and put oil and gas management on its high-risk list for waste, fraud, and abuse. This is an annual analysis or semi-annual.
Yeah, just as a quick backing up, so GAO, Government Accountability Office, and as Autumn says, every 2 years they do a report that's like government-wide saying, here are the areas where we are at risk of creating liabilities, of wasting money, of doing a bad job.
Right, and this is an area they've identified in their list and has repeatedly been on that list since 2011 as a place for high risk for waste, fraud, and abuse because the way that royalties are calculated, the valuation of them, the transparency and collection, the audit system, there are layers of issues that they've identified. And we are, of course, concerned to see that it's still repeatedly on there, even though we're advocating for reforms.
So tell us what you learned, what we did last week, about the report that came out last week.
Right. So we are looking at places where we're seeing a lot of production of oil and gas and trying to identify places where these reforms would have the most sort of bang for the buck. And in New Mexico, we have the highest production levels on federal land. And so there is a real incentive to make sure where we have competitive leasing and we have real reserves, identified reserves, and there's a lot of production going on, the taxpayers are getting a fair return. So we really started digging into that, and what we saw is that the states are charging a much higher royalty rate than the federal government is, up to 20% when we're charging at 12.5%. And that gap has left about $5 billion conservatively on the table, and that's real money to both the states and federal taxpayers because we share our federal royalties 50-50 with the states. So the state of New Mexico has a lot to benefit from royalty reform on federal lands, and so do federal taxpayers. So what we're saying here in this report is really looking at some simple changes to increase royalty rates and get that revenue and not leave it on the table. In addition to looking at the royalty rate in that report in New Mexico, we also looked at rental rates, minimum bids, and lost gas, which is basically gas that is wasted during the production of oil and gas, bringing that to market. So you just have gas that's either leaked, vented, or flared that doesn't ever get to market that royalties aren't charged on as well. So that's another place for a lot of lost revenue, a big issue of concern for us. Since 2011, we've been analyzing methane losses and that gas not getting to market and the losses of royalties to federal taxpayers. We've done several reports, and it's another issue that we'll continue to track as policies change in the current administration that lead to increased waste.
So we have a ton of stuff on oil and gas on our website, including the report that we released last week on New Mexico oil and gas production and royalties. So go to our website, taxpayer.net.
One thing I think is important too is sometimes you hear people complaining about if you increase royalties, then there isn't going to be production, and so we won't get that revenue. But in reality, we're not losing that asset. That oil is there that can be developed later and still generate that revenue when it makes sense. And so from that perspective, it's just it isn't lost revenue in that respect. It's actually future revenue.
Right. And I mean, the price of oil is really what drives development. And you can see, especially in New Mexico, that these lands, these federal lands, are adjacent to state lands, charging a much higher royalty and having that production come to market without any problem. And it's not, this is money that's left on the table for taxpayers, but that isn't driving development.
Right, it's just a red herring.
Yep. So just a reminder, you're listening to Common Sense Conversations with Taxpayers for Common Sense. I'm Ryan Alexander, and I'm here with Steve Ellis, Autumn Hanna, and Wendy Jordan. We're talking about all the ways in which revenue is foregone, that we leave money on the table at the federal government. And if you have any questions, please email them to us at president@taxpayer.net, and we will try to answer them. So I'm going to turn now to Wendy Jordan to provide an example of kind of where the Department of Defense is not collecting money from contractors who have failed to meet the terms of their contracts. You know, we talk a lot about kind of where the Department of Defense spends crazy amounts of money and isn't necessarily paying attention to whether or not they're getting what they need. But the contract issue is kind of a little different. Wendy?
Yes. People who follow TCS's work are aware that we write a lot about the F-35 aircraft program. To review it briefly, the F-35 is a joint aircraft program that will be flown by all three branches of the military that fly fighter aircraft. So the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. It will be the most expensive procurement program in the Department of Defense to date. Acquisition costs are projected to be about $400 billion. But if you add sustainment costs, all the things beyond procurement that are involved in running a fighter aircraft program, and you multiply it by the 35 to 40 year lifespan, expected lifespan of the program, you're talking about an estimated $1 trillion for the F-35 program over the life of its airframes. So at TCS, we pay attention to the program. It's a lot of money. And we read all the publicly available government reports on its progress. And about 2 weeks ago, the Inspector General of the Pentagon issued the results of its investigation of a particular fairly small aspect of the program, which has to do with spare parts. And it was a highly critical report of the Joint Program Office. Again, it's a Joint Program Office because three military services will be flying the aircraft. So the program office is not simply within the Air Force or the Navy. It's a joint office, and the three services rotate their control or running of the program office. Specifically, the IG said that the F-35 contractor, and that's Lockheed Martin, was found to be delivering non-compliant spare parts in the dry prose of government contract law. It's actually called ready for issue parts if they are compliant. So these are non-ready for issue spare parts.
I mean, in plain language, they're sending parts that are not ready to go and they're not what they need.
Correct. And they're critical pieces like wheels, ejection seats.
Sure. I would think most parts of a fighter pilot plane are critical. Maybe a few things are cosmetic, but, you know.
Ejection seats.
Right.
You know, if you're the pilot, you want an ejection seat that for sure works. And window assemblies. Now, that could be a number of things besides just the canopy. The non-compliant parts were found to have been delivered at least as far back as 2015. So for 4 years, parts that are not compliant with the contract in a number of areas have been delivered by Lockheed Martin. In particular, the parts didn't have what's called, this gets into the weeds, an electronic logbook. An electronic logbook maintains the records of maintenance for a part, and it also, more critically, keeps a record of how many flight hours that part has had. And that has to do, obviously, with how old it is. It's like, how old is the muffler on your car?
Right.
You want to keep track of the last time you, you know, replaced your timing belt. It's that sort of thing. So if you don't have an electronic logbook, that means that Pentagon personnel have to manually record that, which is, you know, has been done for decades, but there's a better way to do it now. And unfortunately, these parts came without their electronic logbook.
That seems amazingly important to have that.
In fact, the IG said it, quote, creates a life and safety concern for air crews.
Just what you don't want.
What you don't want. Even worse than that, besides the fact that they were accepting non-compliant parts, DOD was also paying performance incentive fees on top of the contract, the normal contract price that had been agreed to between Lockheed Martin and the Pentagon.
Get us those bad parts fast.
Right.
They had additional incentive fees for meeting certain thresholds. And so non-compliant parts were evidently delivered on time.
Great.
And so they got their incentive fees. So in the world of DOD spending, we're talking about a fairly small amount of money. The incentive fees were $10.5 million, according to the IG.
Something we'd all like to have.
Indeed. I'd like it in my checking account. But overall, DOD lost close to just under $315 million in payments to the contractor for non-compliant parts since 2015.
And just for, you know, before we move on to kind of what, if anything, anybody's going to do about this, it's, you know, they're delivering non-compliant parts and they don't have what they need. They then have to spend money to get good ejection seats, right?
Well, we don't know that the ejection seats are bad.
Right.
But we know that they do not have the systems in place to maintain information about those ejection seats.
Right.
So it's a little bit of hit or miss.
Yeah. So, you know, what is anybody going to do about this? Is Congress looking at it? Is the agency concerned?
The IG report ends with, I think, a remarkably weak recommendation. We recommend that the program executive officer for the F-35 JPO, that's Joint Program Office, pursue compensation for the from the contractor for costs of non-RFI spare parts that have been delivered since 2015. Wow, really?
Pursue.
Ask
them nicely.
We recommend that you pursue compensation. So we were very glad to see that Representative Steve Cohen of Tennessee has submitted an amendment for when the defense policy bill, the National Defense Authorization Bill, is on the floor in the next couple of weeks in the House. Mr. Cohen has offered an amendment that would require the Secretary of Defense to pursue compensation. So we are hopeful that the Rules Committee in the House will make that amendment in order, and we're very supportive of it.
A couple things on that. I mean, just to kind of explain the politics of it. First of all, there's some bipartisan interest in this, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, often when you're looking for members of Congress to hold the Department of Defense accountable, you do not get it from people who have big bases in their districts. But in this case, it's a little different, right?
Right. When I have been speaking to people about this issue and trying to raise its profile on the Hill, I used to work for a member of Congress that had two major military bases in his district. And if this had been the case when I was working on the Hill, I would have said to my boss, this isn't about attacking the F-35. That's not the point of this. The point of this is to make sure that the pilots that are flying the F-35 have safe, compliant equipment. And it's a safety issue, as the IG points out.
I was about to say, as the IG says, an issue of life and safety.
Right.
Two things one is concerned about.
Yes.
So moving on from that, as I hinted at the beginning of the conversation, you know, another thing where we just throw money away sometimes is through something called improper payments, which sounds as boring as you can get. You know, that includes a lot of different things, including the payments to people who may or may not be dead, and it is a lot of money. Steve, you want to kind of talk about the scale and the nature of the problem and kind of where it's happening?
Sure. So improper payments, in a kind of a dull sense, it's a payment that the government makes to either the wrong person or in the wrong amount, which can be too high or too low, or for the wrong reason. And it's a small deal maybe to the government overall, it's not a small deal to most of us and the people who are listening. We're talking about in 2018, there were about $151 billion in improper payments. And since 2003, it's been tabulated that it's about, by the Government Accountability Office, to be about $1.5 trillion in improper payments. Now, of that, there's about, in 2018, roughly $1 billion, just under $1 billion, were improper payments where the agencies had failed to verify the death data. And so in that case, it means that the Social Security Administration maintains a master death file that any agency who's making a payment, whether it's a farm payment or a payment Social Security or any other kind of government payment, they're supposed to verify against the master death file that that person who is to receive the payment is in fact alive.
Yeah. So what are some other kinds of examples of improper payments? I mean, the idea of we don't know whether or not those people are dead, obviously important, but that's not the only thing.
No. And in this case too, even though you don't verify whether they're dead or not, it doesn't mean that they are actually dead. It means that the agency didn't actually go through that step, that important step, to actually verify that the person is actually alive. And so kind of like what Wendy indicated, you know, that doesn't mean that the parts are necessarily bad. In this case, it doesn't mean the person is necessarily dead that they're sending it. It just means that they haven't checked the box.
Or they could be a defense contractor.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's all sorts of, as you can imagine, in a $4 trillion federal budget, there's all sorts of payments that go out. You know, it could be in loans or other means as well. But also I should flag too, and this is kind of one of the little problems on this, is that in 2018, that amount, that $1 billion in improper payments, most of which is Social Security, would only total 0.7% of the total Social Security payments that year.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge program. So, but this is one place where I can actually happily say is that Congress has actually been fairly good on this issue. I mean, there's an improperpayments.gov page. They've directed the agencies to get serious about it. There's been oversight on these areas. There's a bill in right now that I don't know if it'll have a lot of effect, but basically that if you're making a payment to somebody over 105 years old, that you are mandated to actually check the death mask or death file. Of course, they're supposed to be doing that anyway. So I don't know whether that's just to underscore.
Interesting that they got to 105, but you know, hey, you got to pick some number.
Right. No, exactly. And then the last thing I will make on this is that, you know, stuff happens. Improper payments happen, and they're going to. I can remember in the Coast Guard, one of the things they told you is that if you got, for instance, a travel claim or money from the government that you didn't actually owe, well, one is, besides telling them that you didn't actually owe that, the other is make sure you don't spend it because that's fraud, and you're going to have to pay it back in spades. And so that's really what you look at is so people pass away, people's parents pass away, and then the Social Security check still comes. You shouldn't keep cashing it. One man in Florida had been doing it for about 10 years. And so those are things where, you know, they have to try to root that out. And this is an easy place, really, that if government follows the rules and checks the box, we can actually eliminate, you know, $150 billion in improper payments each year.
Right. I mean, I think one thing that I, about all of these things is that, you know, the point isn't that the government is not competent to solve these problems. It's that there are so many problems for the government to solve, and it's important to make sure that somebody's focused on them because, you know, it is a huge, complex organization, and it is kind of the research and highlighting of inspector generals, government accountability organization, people like us that say, oh, wait, this is something you really need to address. You know, one thing a memorable moment of my time at Taxpayers for Common Sense is, you know, we've always done a lot of work on back when there were earmarks, but also kind of certain kinds of defense spending. And we got a call from the Government Accountability Office to kind of meet with us about some of the research we were doing. And they brought in like six people, and they came into our little storefront office, and they were like, we thought you'd have like a whole building. And, you know, and I was like, this is 50% of my staff. And it was, you know, just all around a conference room. And so, you know, and we're not alone. There are other really great research organizations that are able to take the time and dig in and identify problems. So it's about making sure that we are getting the excellence we need from government, not just being, you know, saying gotcha and saying, you can't do anything right. There's, you know, as Steve says, improper payments is a great example where there's no person in Congress who is the defender of improper payments. There is wide agreement that that's something that can be solved with more oversight and more attention. Wendy, you look like you have a deep, profound thought.
Oh, no, not at all.
None.
Yes, I do, but I'll save it for the next time.
Okay. So we are almost at the end of our time. I want to make sure that actually, wow, excellent timing. We are literally 1 minute before the half hour that we usually try to do. If you, you know, feel free to send more questions because we do try to answer things that come in through email. So president@taxpayer.net. And again, this is Ryan Alexander. Thank you so much for listening to our monthly Common Sense Conversation. I just want to point out one thing. We usually do these conversations on the first Monday of the month. We're going to take August off. We will be in the office, but we will not be doing this conversation. And then in September, the first Monday is, I believe, the 7th. It's a little late because of Labor Day, the first Monday workday. So we'll send out an invitation. We'll make sure you know about it. And I hope you'll join us in September. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.